Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Slow Burn Media, an evergreen podcast, presents Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless.
And first at 5:30, more than 20 years have passed with few answers about a series of murders in the Connecticut River Valley.
People in that area suspect it was the work of a serial killer. In the late 1970s and through the 80s, several women disappeared around the Claremont area and in nearby Vermont. The Attorney General's office says it still can't be certain how many cases are related. Today, a state lawmaker tried drawing new attention to it all. Heather Hamill live now, and Heather, this attempt didn't get much traction.
Well, that's true, Jean, because Representative Steve Lindsey, who introduced the bill, recommended killing it as well. No one other than Lindsey even spoke for or against it, and in the end, his unusual way of going about this was questioned by committee members.
In the late 70s and 1980s, the crime shook the very core of the Connecticut River Valley. At least seven women stabbed and murdered. In 2011, still no arrests. Keene Representative Steve Lindsey says he wants answers and justice.
And women without too many ties, women that were easily forgotten. I'd like to reignite interest in the case, and I'd like to bring some resolution.
Lindsey introduced a bill that would give the state's cold case unit $200,000 to exhume the victims of the so-called Connecticut River Valley Killer and perform DNA testing.
Hello and welcome to episode 197 of Who Killed? I'm your host, Bill Huffman, and this is a Slow Burn Media, Evergreen Podcasts, and Killer Podcast production. On this week's episode, I am very lucky to be joined by a survivor of the Connecticut River Valley serial killer, and that is one Jane Borowski. Very nice to have you on the show, and thank you so much for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me and allowing me to share my story.
Yes, your story is something that is a little different than what we do normally on this show, but we do always like to keep our victims and unsolved cases on the forefront. And since you are our victim of this case, I would really be interested in knowing what it is that impacted, or basically how this all started in your life. And if you could just start from, how you got involved, unfortunately, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, I was 22. It was 1988. And I went to a fair. I live in a small community in New Hampshire, Swansea, Winchester, Hinsdale, that area. I went to a fair that night, the county fair, Cheshire County Fair. It's a fair that every year they have it, and people just congregate there and meet up with different people they know, and it's a family fun fair. So I went to the fair and walked around, ran into a bunch of people I knew, did a little bit of chit-chat here, chit-chat there. And then I was leaving the fair. It was 11-ish, 11:30-ish. It was hot. That summer was brutally hot and humid. I was 7 months pregnant with my daughter. And I started going home. And I was driving through Swansea on a main road. Now this town has virtually no major crime whatsoever. And I knew there was a store right on Route 10 that it was closed, but I knew it had a vending machine outside, a soda vending machine. So I pulled in and parked in front of the soda machine and got some change out and went and got a soda. And I'm in my car and I'm drinking my soda, getting ready to leave. And this Jeep Wagoneer pulled up beside me on my passenger side. I didn't think anything of it. There's a payphone sitting there. There's a soda machine sitting there. I really didn't think anything of it. And then he walked around the backside of my car and came over to my driver's side door and asked me if the phone worked. And right as he did that, he opened my door and tried to take me out of my car. And we struggled. I fought quite a bit. I fought so much that somehow my feet came up. I was kicking him and I smashed my windshield when I kicked him. And after struggling and fighting and screaming, he took a knife out and said, maybe this will persuade you to get out of the car. And I did. It did. And I got out of the car and we're standing by my car. And, you know, at first I was scared and he was just acting so calm. But yet acting weird. Because all of a sudden he was like, you beat up my girlfriend. And isn't this a Massachusetts car? So I'm like thinking, okay, this guy is like out there somewhere and he's confusing me with somebody else. And so I said, no, this is a New Hampshire car. And he walked around the backside of my car to look at my plates and started walking back to his vehicle. And I was like, what is this guy doing? I didn't feel threatened at that time. I just felt like he confused me with somebody else. And then I realized, you know what? I got a smashed windshield. So I said these words I will regret for the rest of my life. I said, hey, a-hole, what about my windshield? As he was walking back to his vehicle. And he turned around and came back to me and put a knife up against my neck. And we stood there for a few seconds. I had no idea what this guy was capable of doing. I mean, you got to remember, this is back before internet, before social media. I had no idea that there were serial killers lurking the state of New Hampshire and Vermont. So I knew nothing about that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you had any awareness that there was such a thing going on, that women were being killed, and if that even was something that they had recognized.
No, I didn't.
And that was just not the case.
Yeah, I mean,
wow.
I was 22. You know, there was no internet or social media back then, so I didn't know anything about these cases. And I saw a car starting to drive by, and I knew the only way I was going to get out of that situation is I needed to run to the road and scream. And so I took off. I started running towards the road and screaming, and the car just drove right by. And he tackled me down just like a football player right on the pavement. And before I knew it, I was on my back and he was on top of me and just started stabbing me. And I ultimately was stabbed 27 times. I had a lot of defensive stab wounds in my hands because I was trying to protect my baby. He did cut my jugular. I ended up having 2 collapsed lungs. He cut my tendon in my hand, a tendon in my knee, lacerated a piece of my liver. I had a piece of my liver removed. But he just, he was on top of me, and I just couldn't, it was almost like an out-of-body experience. I couldn't believe this was happening. This guy was just stabbing the crap out of me. And all of a sudden, he just stopped and got up and walked. He was walking away. He wasn't running. He was walking. And I was laying there thinking very, very casually, like it was.
Like casually.
I don't know. He was so calm throughout the whole thing. It's like he never got mad, but never showed emotion. You know, he did want me to go with him at first.
Yeah.
It was very evident that he wanted me to go with him to begin with. And I wasn't going to. I was fighting him pretty bad about that. But, yeah.
This is all going on outside of the store?
Yep. This,
by your car?
Yeah. In the parking lot.
And what? And you said it was late. And this was like close to like midnight, you said.
Yep.
So it would have been not busy.
No.
I guess. So there was no witnesses or anything other than you.
Yeah.
That must have been obviously the scariest thing to ever happen. Now you said at first you weren't, I don't know. I mean, you kind of made it sound like you weren't too scared of him at first. And then
once we got out of the car and he started talking about me beating up his girlfriend and I had Massachusetts plates on my car, which I didn't. I didn't feel threatened anymore. I thought maybe this guy was just confusing me with somebody else.
Once he starts going crazy talk like that, where he's referencing fighting his girlfriend, yeah, having different plates, where you then say, no, I have New Hampshire plates. And, you know, it's, you got to be like, this guy's lost his freaking mind. Yeah,
that's exactly what I was thinking. Skies.
And not he's going to stab me a billion, 27 times, yeah, you know, and I mean, so like you said, most of your wounds were, or a lot of your wounds were defensive,
yeah,
but you had two collapsed lungs and a sliced jugular vein. How in the world were you able to do what you did next? And what is it that you did next?
Well, When I heard him walk away, I obviously didn't know where he was. I was laying on the ground still. And I somehow got up on my hands and knees to get up. And I heard his vehicle start driving by me. And I looked up and he just drove right by me. Didn't speed off or anything. He just drove right by me and looked right down at me. And I looked right at him. And He just drove off. So I eventually got up and got to my car. I was bleeding pretty bad. I could hear the blood just gushing out of me. And I got in my car, and I knew my friend lived about 2 miles down the road on that main road. So I said, okay, I got to get help. I've got to get to his house. He can get me help. So I pulled out and I started driving towards my friend's house, and before I know it, I'm right behind him. I'm like, oh my God, there he is. He's right in front of me. And I was so scared. I was like, he's going to see where I pull in. I was terrified of that. And so my friend's house came, and I pulled into my friend's house, his driveway, and the monster just kept driving along. And so when I got to the house, my friend came to the door. He came to his screen door, and I told him somebody just stabbed the crap out of me and I needed help. And I ended up collapsing on his stairs, and that's when the police came and the rescue came and all that.
So basically you feel like adrenaline got you, and the survivor instinct of keeping, yeah, your baby alive is probably what drove you to
I'm a true believer. I would not be alive if I wasn't pregnant. True believer of that. She gave me the strength, and she wanted to survive, which gave me the strength to survive.
You were fighting for two people.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, I guess that's, if you think about it and you think about this particular perpetrator, you're the only survivor.
Yeah.
So that.
But I didn't know that for 2 weeks. I was in the hospital for 2 weeks, and
yeah, what happened after that?
Read it in the paper.
Okay.
I read it in the paper.
So the police didn't inform you that there were. Did they know? Were the police aware?
Yes.
Okay. So they were quick to put two and two together.
Yeah.
Now, I've read that you were able to get some of the license plate.
Yeah, they had me go to a criminal profiler, John Philpin, he was really involved with all the cases. So he hypnotized me to try to get, you know, some kind of license plate. I guess while I was hypnotized, the license plate was really dirty. So I really had a hard time getting anything off it. I believe some of the numbers were like 336 or 226 or something like that. I really don't think it's reliable.
Right.
Because it was so dirty. Because I don't remember seeing the license plate that night. My body obviously went into shock and I was just focusing on getting help. So I really didn't.
So this is a very interesting situation that you find yourself in at that point in time where you're pregnant and your baby survives.
My baby survived. I actually carried her full term until for 2 months after, amazingly.
That is amazing. And were you able to, I mean, were you recovered by the time you were giving birth? I mean, that must have been just another traumatic experience on top of, you know, everything.
Yeah, I was in the hospital for a few weeks.
Okay.
I was in ICU for 5 days. I was on a ventilator because obviously I had 2 collapsed lungs and everything else. I went into surgery immediately that night of my attack, and they removed a piece of my liver, and I remember having tubes in my sides for the ventilator for my collapsed lungs, and yeah, I was in pretty bad shape. They didn't think I was going to survive. Even in the hospital, they didn't think I was going to survive. So I was in ICU for about 5 days, and then I went into a regular room. And this whole time, I had a security. I had a police officer outside my door. So everybody that went in and out, there was only immediate family allowed in to see me.
That had to be a little comforting.
It was once I realized, yeah. Because I didn't realize anything for like 5 days. And then when I went into the my regular room, my family kind of sheltered me from all the news media and the newspapers and all that. So I really didn't know what was going on the outside world. I just knew what was going on in the hospital. And I knew there was a police officer at my door all the time. And one day my mother was at the hospital and we were sitting, this was when I was in my regular room, and I was like, Dennis, my husband, I said, why is Dennis so determined for me not to watch the news or look at the newspapers or anything? Because every time they brought newspapers in, he'd take the newspaper. And my mother was like, you're all over the news. And I'm like, what do you mean I'm all over the news? She's like, oh, you're all over CNN. You're on WMUR, Channel 9 News in New Hampshire. You're in Mass on all the news channels in Mass. You're in the newspapers everywhere. And I'm like, are you kidding me? That didn't bother me. What bothered me was as soon as I found out that my name was everywhere. And I was like, this guy has not been caught yet. And my name is everywhere. Now, they don't do that today. Now the victims' names are not revealed at all in the news or the newspaper or anything like that. But back then it was. And it was like, do they even realize how much danger they put me in? So I
as a journalist, that is so frustrating.
Isn't it?
Never, isn't it? Never, ever, ever do that.
No.
I mean, I'm so sorry that you had to be, because that puts, that's like a whole nother added stress to your life that you've already, you're dealing with so much to begin with, and now you've get outed in the newspaper as being one of, being the victim that survived.
Yeah.
I mean, how is that not gonna,
that's just
foolishness in my opinion, and not thinking things through, but times have changed.
They have. Thank God.
Yeah. That kind of brings me to the point where physically you're stabbed 27 times. How long was it before you felt like, I mean, did you fully recover?
I did physically. You know, it took me about a month to fully recover. You know, my tendon in my hand and my tendon in my knee took quite a while to recover. I had to do a lot of physical therapy and stuff like that. But yeah, physically, yeah. I recovered pretty good.
Mentally,
not so much. No. You know, while I was in the hospital, when a nurse came in with a newspaper, and that's when I read that they were connecting me with the Connecticut River Valley killings. And that really did a job on me mentally. And when the detectives came to the hospital to see me, they came quite a few times to interview me and stuff. And, you know, I was like, is this true? And, you know, they were like, yeah, yeah. And every day they came to the hospital, I was like, so you find him yet? You catch him yet? Because I'm thinking in my mind, they're going to find out who this is and catch him and arrest him. And I didn't have to, you know, have to worry about it anymore. But when the day that came that I was being released, I said to them, okay, is this gentleman outside my door coming to my house to protect me? And, obviously not. They were like, no, no. But we're going to have police. The police in your town will do drive-bys around by your house. And I was just like, are you kidding me? This is just crazy. So it was like shortly, like right after I got home, my nightmares started. My nightmares got really bad. And yeah, mentally I was a mess. And then when I had my daughter, you know, I was, so much stuff goes through my mind. It's like, I don't even know how to protect myself. How am I going to protect my daughter? You know, it's like, it was just, it was a very, very difficult time in my life. Very, very difficult. And, you know, it's every week that went by, I kept thinking, they're going to find him. They're going to catch him. They're going to figure out who this was. And, you know, every week came by and no, they never found him, never arrested him, never identified him, anything, you know. To this day, it's still unsolved. All of them are.
That is where I was going next. And that was how this case has remained unsolved when we have a survivor like you. And you were able to get a composite sketch, or?
Yeah, I did a composite.
How long after you were attacked did they actually ask you for your information about what you saw, who you thought this guy did, or was that during the when you were hypnotized? Because I know that, like, you see it on TV, and they come into the hospital and they, God, let me talk to the victim, and they're like, we can't do that, you know, blah 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 blah, but they always seem to do that. So,
well, it's interesting because when they did the composite, I was still in ICU and I was still on a ventilator. So they came in with this box and it had like different films of eyes and nose and you know, the face shape and the hair, and I laid in bed and I blinked.
Identikit. Oh my gosh.
Are these the eyes? And I blink, and show me something else, and I blink once or blink twice, once for yes, twice for no. And you know, that was when, it was like after I got out of the hospital, I kind of wondered why they did that. But then I'm thinking, oh my God, they didn't even think I was going to survive. So they had to get some kind of composite out there in case I didn't survive. So I wasn't able to.
Fair enough.
But as soon as I had the ventilator out and I was in my regular room, they came up pretty regularly to interview me and to find out exactly what happened that night. Because they didn't know exactly what happened that night because I was on a ventilator and I couldn't speak and I was completely out of it. I mean, I don't remember anything those 5 days. But yeah, so it was shortly after that when I was in my regular room is when they came in and started getting the real story and real information about exactly what happened.
Now, you mentioned when you left the, you know, you got home, the nightmares began. And PTSD is obviously something that you had to deal with and deal with probably still to this day, I'm sure. It doesn't just go away, unfortunately. Can you explain a little bit about how you've been able to deal with that?
Well, I did not realize I had PTSD until 2010. It was 20 years after my attack.
It's fair to say, though, the diagnosis back in 1988 probably wouldn't have been the same as it was. Psychology came a little bit
away. It's so different, you know. Now. It's like now when victims or survivors are in, you know, have some kind of trauma or whatever and say they're in the hospital, the first thing they do is they offer them counseling before they leave. They give them some kind of counseling tools before they leave. Back then, they didn't do that. It was like, okay, physically, you're healed. You're being discharged. Have a nice life. I hope you, you know, stay safe or whatever. And that was pretty much what the case was with me. You know, I tried to live a normal life as much as I could. I tried to move forward. I tried to not allow it to control my life. But the reality is it did. I made a lot of bad choices because of the state of mind I was in for so many years. And, you know, I ended up becoming a real serious compulsive gambler. Gambling for me, it was my escape from the reality of what happened to me. It was the only thing I could think of I could go and I could gamble and I didn't have to think about it anymore. And because of that, I made a lot of bad choices in my life. And in 2010, I hit rock bottom and I went to jail because I stole from an organization that I loved very much. I was a part of it for 25 years, and I ended up going to jail for it. But I never used my attack as an excuse. I've always taken full responsibility for my bad choices that I've made. But I was also court ordered to go to counseling for my gambling, and it was while I was in counseling for my gambling, about 2 months later, I had an excellent counselor. She was so awesome. I had told her about my attack about 2 months after, and she was like, "This happened to you? Oh my God." And, you know, we started talking about it more, and she's like, "I want to clinically diagnose you with PTSD." And I was like, "PTSD is for like veterans that have fought overseas, you know, and wars and." And she's like, "No, I'm." So she went over the computer and she printed me out a bunch of symptoms of PTSD. And she gave me the paper and she said, "You go home, you read this. And then you come back next week and you tell me what you think." And it had been in my pocketbook for a couple of days. And I happened to take it out and I'm looking at it and I'm like, "Oh my God, I have PTSD." I had every single one of those symptoms. Every single one of those symptoms affected my life in such a negative way. And so I went back. I said, "Okay, I have PTSD. Now what?" And she said, "Now we start healing you." And that's what we did. It took 7 years. I still heal every day. It's a process. But for the first 7 years, it was like I did some real good, intense counseling. We addressed every single one of my symptoms and you know, made me see how it affected my life in a negative way and how I can turn it around to be positive. And after 7 years, I was just like, "Wow, I now realize I didn't live a normal life." And for the first 20 years after my attack, that was just a facade that I was living. But now I live a very happy, normal life. I've become a person I've always wanted to be. You know, I wake up every morning. I'm going to be a better person today than I was yesterday. And that's what I strive to do. And that's one of the reasons why I want to tell my story. You know, I want people to say, you know, wow, I've gone through something traumatic and I've never been able to talk about it. But I'm listening to Jane and I want to talk about it now. I want to, you know, heal. You know, if I help that one person, that's my whole purpose of doing this podcast, Invisible Tears. It's, I just want to help that one person.
Yeah, I you kind of leave me without words.
I'm sorry.
No.
I kind of threw everything at you.
I'm a huge, huge proponent of therapy. I've been in therapy since I was 10. So, you know, I was lucky enough to have that mom who was there to say, you know, you probably should go see somebody. And I remember having the epiphany being like, I'm not talking to some, yeah, I don't need to do that. You know, there's nothing wrong with me. And
you didn't want to show weakness.
No, I was 10 years old. I was a tough little boy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the next night I had the same issues, like not being able to sleep and anxiety. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. I'm ready.
Yeah.
And, once you come to that sort of, realization, it doesn't matter if you're young, you're old, or, you know, whatever age you are, it's just like it opens up your whole world to see a difference that you've never seen before. I mean, it's a whole new world, as they say, not to sound cliche, but it's true. And what you went through, my goodness. I mean, your therapist, what did your therapist, in regards to like your decision making, you said you don't blame your actions for, you know, what you did on your attack, but the underlying factor is it did play a role in.
Oh, exactly. I've always said, you know, I take full responsibility for my bad choices, but my counselor did, she did say, you know, you can't help but notice it and realize that. It was my bad choices were a direct result of my attack and the lack of counseling or no counseling I didn't receive for 20 years. So, yeah, I mean, even though I do take responsibility, I kind of wonder, you know, if I wasn't attacked, would I have made those bad choices in my life? Would I have began gambling, my gambling addiction? Probably not.
Yeah, you know, you see a lot of people that cover it up with alcohol and drugs and, you know, a variety of other things, other addictions. You know, there's just a myriad of issues that you can get yourself involved with if you're not addressing, you know, not to make it like a sports cliche, but, you know, if you're a runner and your left foot's hurt, and you start then favoring your right foot, guess what? Your right foot ends up hurting. And so it's just a catch-22. And without receiving counseling, I mean, I can't even fathom what you went through for 20 years of your life without receiving the appropriate counseling that you deserved as a victim. I just feel so bad for you in that regard. Like, that's just such a drop of the ball by health providers, you know, just people who should be able to say, hey, you know, you should probably get some counseling too if they're gonna make you do it for gambling addiction. You know, again, times were different, but still, when I made
times were different, but I hit a lot of things.
Okay.
I hit a lot of things. You know, I cried a million tears in silence. I never showed anybody what I was really going through in my head.
Hence invisible tears.
You know, I attempted suicide twice.
Oh, no.
I went through such depression. But my depression, I was going through the depression like in my bedroom, in my privacy of my bedroom. But once I walked out that door, I had to put on this. For some reason, I felt like I couldn't show weakness. I had to be strong. So once I walked out that door, I was like, okay, I'm not going to show how I'm feeling today. I'm just going to try to, you know, move on and do a normal life, you know, and my life was nothing but normal. Oh, now, you know, once I was sitting in that jail cell and I realized, holy crap, my life is messed up and I need to do something to change it. And that's what I did, you know. I didn't have much hope while I was in jail, but once I got my counseling, I have a lot of hope now, you know. My life is so good. I have a granddaughter. My daughter survived, and she blessed me with the most beautiful granddaughter. She's going to be 9. And, I'm so blessed and so thankful for where my life is today. But I don't know that my life would be like this today if I hadn't gone through all those learning, all the learning bad choices, you know, the bad choices I made, I had to learn from. And so, you know, maybe that turned me into the person I am today and my life, the way my life is today.
That's a totally fair assessment. I think that the decisions that we make along the way in our lives do dictate the people, you know, we become. Good choices and bad, we've all made them. You know, it's some at different levels. That's the one thing, you know, there's no therapy that fits one person. That fits all people. It's everybody's different. You know, you got to approach things differently. I mean, your story is obviously completely different than anybody else's story who goes into counseling. And I just think it's such an important part of our culture that has been stigmatized that people don't turn to counseling for help. And it's such a sad state of affairs, in my opinion, because it's not a sign of weakness at all. It's actually a sign of courage and a sign of bravery because you're willing to explore the inner depths of you. And there's nothing more.
Exactly.
You know, how many people have you run into since you've been out of therapy then you're just like, you need therapy, and you just in your mind, you don't say it because you know better, but you know, how many people, Jane, how many?
There's been a few.
It opens your eyes and you really see things from a new perspective. And I'm so happy that you got that counseling that you did. During that counseling, did you guys discuss the case at all that you were involved with?
Somewhat. We talked a lot about him.
Okay.
At first, I didn't want to because I just I felt too much attention was put on him with everything. So I really didn't want to talk about him much. And she's like, he did this to you, you know? You got to talk about him. And that's when I realized how much anger I had inside me with him and about him. And I knew I had a lot of anger inside me, but I didn't realize how much until we started to talk about him and all that stuff. So it was like, now I can talk about him, but I don't talk about him a lot. It's like, you know, I don't think he's human. I refer to him as evil or a monster. He's definitely not a human being as far as I'm concerned. But we also talked about, as far as the cases are concerned, one of the things I had to deal with a lot too was survival guilt. Survival guilt is a very real thing. And I didn't realize how much it was affecting me until we really started talking about it. Because it was like, you know, these 7 women were killed, and I survived. I can't even and what was going through my mind was, I can't imagine how that their families must feel about me. Like, they must feel like, she survived, why couldn't our loved ones survive, you know? And, you know, it wasn't till a few years after I realized that these families were very grateful that I survived. And it was eye-opening. Survival guilt is so real, and it did eat at me a lot. And we talked about that a lot. It was hard. It was hard getting past that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but I didn't really want to open that can of worms earlier when I mentioned that you were the only survivor, and I just didn't want to put that on you because of all the other stuff that you have to go through as well. So explain to me a little bit about how you've been able to overcome that survivor's guilt. I mean, I know that's probably something you still deal with daily.
I don't as much. The way I look at it is, I survived for a reason. And, you know, I'm a true believer that everything happens for a reason in our lives. And I survived because now I can be these women's voice. These women don't have a voice anymore because they were so brutally murdered and it was taken away from them. I can be their voice now, and I can relate to what they went through, and not a lot of people can do that. And, you know, I don't feel the guilt anymore. I feel like, instead of thinking so negative about it now, I think more positive. What can I do positive to, you know, I survived, these women didn't. What can I do positive? And I can tell their stories, you know, and that's what I want to do. I want to more focus. If you look up these women online, mm-hmm. all you see is that they were murdered, you know, what they went through, they were murdered. But you don't know that most of them have brothers and sisters, what their interests were. They had lives before they were so brutally taken away. And I'm going to be able to be their voice to tell their stories and to talk about them in their real lives, not just about what happened to them. And I'm thankful for that.
That's amazing. And that's a really interesting perspective to have, great perspective to have on this case, especially being in the position that you're in. It's a way to honor them, and it's a way to keep the story going, because, you know, once the media stops following stories, it kind of, you know, that's when they become cold cases. And you know, what do you do when the media stops following your case? And I mean, you probably had, how long did the media follow your case before they trailed off? And
probably about a year, give or take about a year.
I mean, for most people, that's a long time. But the fact that the case didn't ever get solved, it should still be something that is on the front and center of all these different towns where these murders took place. And we're not talking, can you explain a little bit to the listener about how small of an area where these bodies were found?
Well, Unity is a very small town. I think they might have 2,000 residents in Unity. A lot of back roads, dirt roads, very isolated. Claremont is a small community. You know, they're very small communities. Especially back in the 80s, they didn't have the strip malls, they didn't have the Walmarts, they didn't have all these big box stores and, you know, all the big, franchise restaurants or anything like that. They were very, very small communities. They've obviously grown over the years, but, you know, where these women were found, it was dirt road, back roads, very isolated, you know, all except for Linda Moore and Barbara Agnew, Well, Barbara Agnew's body was found in Kellyville, and that was a very small community, small town. She was found in the woods. So, yeah, it's very isolated areas.
Easy to be a serial killer, I guess, is a bad way of putting it, but not a lot of people out there to tell you or catch you doing what you're doing if you're disposing of people's remains in these completely isolated areas. But the fact that these towns are so small, one is left to believe that the killer has to be somebody that was somebody local.
Yeah. We went up, me and my team went up to the Claremont area to where most of the bodies were found about a couple of months ago. First time I've been up there to actually see where their bodies were found. And it was, to me, he knows the area. He knows the area very well. Like two of the victims, like Elizabeth Critchley and Eva Morse, their bodies were found 500 feet apart, but 5 years apart. So he revisited that area.
For sure.
You know, so he's a lot of these places, we had a hard time finding these roads and where these bodies were found. So he knew the area because he, where he put them, it was very isolated, very, very isolated.
There's just no, so basically what you're saying is there's no way that any random Joe is just going to end up where he ended up putting those bodies. He had to know where he was going.
Yeah, no. Yeah, he had it planned before he even found the victims.
He knew exactly where he was going with those people.
It was so evident.
You mentioned your team. So what does your team consist of? And are you guys investigating the crime?
Well, let's start with when we started Invisible Tears.
Let's hear it.
We were in lockdown with the pandemic. And me and my daughter were listening to some podcasts. And she's like, oh, let's punch up your name. So she punched up my name, and all of a sudden we're hearing podcasts about my attack. I was like, oh, listen to that. And she's like, oh my God, they're so wrong. And listen to them. They're just reading off the internet. She's like, that's just, you need to do a podcast. You need to tell your story in your words. And, I have no technical experience whatsoever with anything. She's the one that had to do the podcast and put that up. So she's like, let's get a hold of Andrew, Drew Bedard. He was his parents have been best friends with us for years. And I actually babysat him when he was young, him and his siblings. So I got a hold of him and I said, what do you think about helping me do a podcast, telling my story? Well, him and his wife, Amanda, they were like, let's do it. And so we just, for the last 2 years, we've been working on it, and we have Invisible Tears, and they are amazing. He's the producer of my podcast. Amanda is my co-host, my life coach. She does all the editing of my podcast. And there's me. So it's a great team. We've become really close. I trust them. I can't imagine doing this with anybody but them, because they make me feel like they make me feel safe. And they let me tell my story. And the way they edit and the way they allow me to tell my story is just amazing. And I'm grateful for them. Totally grateful for them.
That's amazing. And it's really amazing that you're going back and revisiting the scenes and, you know, taking that extra step to dive deeper into this case. And Do you feel like it's getting any close? I mean, I noticed that there were a couple suspects on the internet, and
one in particular.
Yeah. So, can you explain? You don't have to go and tell me the name, but like, is there anybody? Is there any chance that this guy is the guy?
Let's get the name out there, Michael Nicolau. You punch up my name, or you punch up the Connecticut River Valley killings, and Michael Nicolau is there. A private investigator contacted me way back in, like, I think it was 2005 or something like that. Told me that she had all this info on this Michael Nicolau guy and felt like he was the Connecticut River Valley killer. And I had formed a relationship with her for about 2 years. And she was super into media attention, like huge media attention. And I very quickly realized that everything that she was doing with this whole Michael Nicolau thing was for her agenda. It wasn't to solve anything. It was to put her in the limelight. And a lot of things that she was saying was just circumstantial and hearsay. And I started picking up on some stuff. And I'm like, well, that's hearsay. And she just felt very strongly that it was Michael Nicolau. And after I had talked to a couple of other people and a couple of private investigators and had them review Michael Nicolau, the detectives in Concord reviewed Michael Nicolau. And we've decided it wasn't Michael Nicolau. Was he a bad man? He was definitely a bad man. I mean, he killed his wife and stepdaughter and possibly his first wife. So, he was a bad man. But was he the Connecticut River Valley killer? No. A lot of things don't fit with him. This private investigator that brought him to my attention was only finding things that, or using things that made him fit into the investigation. She never did any elimination, I should say. And there was a lot of things to eliminate him, but she never focused on that. She just tried, she'd find something and say, well, you know, he may have been in this area at that time because I found this, or, you know, so she always tried to make him fit. But I really tried to listen to her with an open mind about everything, you know, because over the years I've had so many people come to me, come knocking on my door. I know who did this to you. I know who the Connecticut River Valley killer is. I've been investigating this for years. It's my brother-in-law, or it's my old classmate, or, you know, different people. So I've heard this, you know, before. So as I'm, when she contacted me, I kind of took everything in, you know, with an open mind because, you know, of all the others that have come forward. But, she kind of took it and ran with it and put it all over the media. And I wish she didn't. And I wish I had not associated with her. But I did. And I can't change it. And I mean, the fact of the matter is these are still unsolved.
Yes.
You know.
Bottom line.
And nobody's ever been arrested. Nobody's ever gone to jail, and these poor families have never seen justice. I mean, some of these family members are passing away now, like Bernice Cornemarsh. Her parents just passed away the past couple of years. And it's sad because now they have no answers. I believe the detectives and the state police could have done more. I believe these are solvable cases. I think they've had a lot of missed opportunities. I sometimes lose faith in them. Like a couple of years ago, they called me up and said, you know, we got fingerprints off your car. Can you come in and be re-fingerprinted? Because when they lifted fingerprints off my car, everybody that had any contact with my car way back then, right after my attack, came in and got fingerprinted. And 2 years ago, they were like, can we re-fingerprint you? We want to just eliminate a couple of more prints. And I said, yeah, I'll come in and be re-fingerprinted. And so he was like, all right, well, we'll contact you in 2 weeks, give you a good time and place to go. And, you know, we talked about where I would go and stuff. And yeah, that's almost, what, 2.5 years, and I still haven't heard back from him.
Oh.
So I don't know if maybe they don't have fingerprints. I don't know.
Oh.
I don't know. I still haven't heard from them, though.
Jeez.
So yeah, I kind of lose faith in them, and I hate it. I hate it. But I think these are solvable cases. I gave them an enormous amount of information. I mean, and I like, one of the things they've always thought, that he had a four-wheel drive. He was driving a Jeep Wagoneer that night, a four-wheel drive, with wood grain siding. I gave the color. You know, I could not have been more detailed with stuff like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's so much information I had given them, and I just don't understand why they're not solved. I really don't.
Do you have a contact there at all, or with law enforcement in general, or not?
No. The main detective that was on my case 34 years ago, he retired.
Okay.
I know that there's been a few. There's a cold case unit in Concord, in New Hampshire, and I know there's been quite a few that have been. You know, they go into the cold cases, or you know. But I know a lot of them had come and gone, too. So I know there's been a lot of fresh eyes on the cases. But it doesn't seem like anything just comes about.
Well,
it's frustrating. Yeah. It's so frustrating.
But that's why you're doing your podcast, and you're doing interviews with me and other shows, and you're keeping the story out there. And, you know, that's the most important thing. And in all reality, is you've taken the reins of your story and you're now in charge of it, and you're not letting the investigation dictate what you know or don't know about this case. And now you have a team that is working with you that has helped you with this podcast, Invisible Tears, which can be found anywhere you get your podcasts. And, you know, highly recommend checking that out. And do you have any like closing thoughts that you would like to leave the listeners with, as far as like,
okay. I do.
Yeah. I'd love to hear them.
I'm also working on another project with Crawl Space Media, Tim and Lance and Jen. We're working on another project called Dark Valley, and that is going to be coming out, in the spring. That's going to be a podcast. And I'm super excited about that, because they're really going to focus on the investigative part of the Connecticut River Valley murders, and the families, I love working with them, and they're also allowing me to tell my story on that podcast. So I'm so thankful for them too. They're such awesome guys.
Yeah, they're great.
So Dark Valley will be coming out in the spring. And I want to bring up Trish Haynes in New Hampshire. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she was murdered. And the two people that killed her are still not arrested. And it's infuriating. They're doing a vigil an event up in Concord, New Hampshire on September 24th. I'm going to be there with her family and her friends and everybody else to try to get these authorities to do something about this. Because it is very evident on who killed her. And I don't understand why those two people are still walking the face of the earth and not in jail. I don't understand it. Invisible Tears. You can find Invisible Tears wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And we have a website, invisible-tears.com. Check out the website. We got a lot of other information on there. And You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. So I think I covered everything.
You're a multimedia machine. I see Tim and Lance have gotten into you.
Yeah, Tim and Lance.
Yes.
But I'm lucky because I don't have to do all that social media stuff. That's Amanda and her daughter. They've been taking care of all that for me, which I'm so grateful for, because I'm not very good at that. So, but and I want to just say the names. Let's get this case solved, and let's say the names of the victims that didn't survive, because we haven't really said their names.
But I know, and I want, yeah, let's do it. Let's
There's Kathy Mulligan. There's Elizabeth Critchley. Eva Morse, Ellen Freed, Bernice Cordemarsh, Linda Moore, and Barbara Agnew. Those are the real victims. They're the ones, they're the reasons why I'm doing this. I want to be their voice, and these cases need to be solved. Let's, enough with the missed opportunities. Let's solve these cases.
I like it. I like it. I think that you have done an incredible job overcoming a lot of the issues that come along with being a victim, being a survivor of a serial killer, which is just not something a lot of people can say. And the fact that you're basically, you're now a victim's advocate, you know, following up on stuff and doing things, you know, appropriately, and you know, following up, and I just think it's really great that you've been able to do this, and you got a team with you, and you know, the Dark Valley coming out with Tim and Lance. I mean, you know, they're rock stars, and you know, I've known them for a while, and so you know, good crew to be hooked up with, and I can't imagine that they will do your story wrong, and they will be on it as. I mean, you couldn't have picked a better duo. So, I mean, I love Nick and the Captain are my guys from True Crime Garage, but Tim and Lance are the multimedia leaders in the podcast world, and yeah, they're quite a force, and they're very funny, and they're very fun, and they can help you make a little bit of humor and a little bit of. Dark situation, and I hope that you've been able to get that from them as well. And
absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely.
I can tell by your smile that you know that they do that. So that's incredible, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much for allowing me to share my story. It means a lot.
Well, it means a lot that you were able to come on and be open and honest and. Share a lot of this very personal stuff, and I think our listeners will be extremely interested in what you had to say, and I just can't thank you enough. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Jane Borowski for joining us this week on Who Killed? As you know, I drop new episodes every Friday. You can check out her podcast on any platform, and that is Invisible Tears. And again, she is also going to be doing Dark Valley in the spring with Tim and Lance. So definitely worth checking out. And again, thanks so much for setting that up. I do appreciate that. She is a survivor, and talking to a survivor of a serial killer is definitely an experience. So kudos to her and what she's been able to overcome in her life. So thank you again for listening. You can follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3. And as you know, you can donate to the show via Venmo at bill-huffman-3 or on slowburnmedia.com on the donate button, and that's slow minus the W. So again, thank you to Jane, thank you to Evergreen, thank you to Slow Burn and Killer Podcasts, and I hope, as always, you guys stay safe and have a great week.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Something is creeping in. Don't follow it down.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy. And you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
It was all fictitious.
You stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt K-L-O-O-G-H-L-E-S-S.